Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. What is it like to live with a mental illness? The National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, states that approximately 1 in 5 adults in the U.S., 43.8 million or 18.5%, experiences mental illness in a given year. That is a lot of people. But still, many people keep their experiences a secret, which keeps the stigma attached to mental illness in place. Today, we're going to read some personal pieces from people living with differing types of mental illnesses. With more and more therapies, medications, and other interventions becoming available, hopefully everyone who needs some help will make their way to finding it. We start with a piece from the New York Times written by Jill Werman Harris, and this personal essay was published on August 5, 2016. Every claustrophobe will tell you that it's the elevator riders who are the crazy ones. That's what I'm muttering as I haul myself up the winding staircase to the Grand Ballroom on the third floor of the Plaza Hotel in a gown on my way to a black tie wedding. A few minutes earlier, I'd taken one look at the elevator in the lobby and determined, no way. If there was an alternate route up, I would find it. My husband shot a knowing look my way and piled into the metal box with too many other guests. An image, even as I write this, that makes me uneasy. Writing what the New York Times in 1891 called the vertical railway. Those who fear being enclosed or narrow spaces, with an emphasis on the inescapability of such, often point to a trigger event. Mine was on an insufferably hot day in August 1985 when I got stuck for 3 hours underground in a packed subway car, with no air conditioning, on the train from 8th Street, while standing next to a large and equally hysterical man eating a mayonnaise sandwich. I had no lingering reaction to condiments, but I haven't been back on the subway since. I did come close a few years ago when I set out to see a Norman Rockwell exhibition in Brooklyn, but I jumped recklessly out of the subway car at the last possible minute. Sadly, it was a spectacular display of florid insanity for my then young children, to whom I often stress important character traits such as resilience and optimism. I am far from alone. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that a little over 3% of the American population has claustrophobia. It's particularly tough to be a claustrophobe on an island of skyscrapers, where the vast majority of people rely on elevators and subways. But while I confess to some resentment of rapid transit's convenience and efficiency, there are other ways to get around. As a nearly 50-year-old mother of two, I have a life here that I cherish. Buses, bicycles, taxis, stair climbing, driving my car, far better alternatives to succumbing to my fear and moving away from New York City. The formula for anxiety is, what if? And then predicating terrible future events without any basis in reality, says Robert Schachter, an assistant clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Part of the spectrum of anxiety disorders, elevator phobia is what all anxiety is about, uncertainty. There are benefits, of course, and I scan the studies, which have informed me that stair climbing can increase bone density and has cardioprotective effects such as lowering blood pressure and cholesterol. Cardiologists tell heart patients that it's safe to have sex if they can comfortably walk up 2 or 3 flights of stairs, and a Canadian study found that doctors who climb hospital stairs arrived at their destination faster than the elevator. No one was more excited than I when Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg announced his stair climbing initiative in 2013 to make New Yorkers healthier by creating visible, attractive, and accessible staircases. Many staircases associated with the approximately 65,000 elevators in New York City remain difficult to get access to because of safety and security concerns. The result is that to be granted access to a stairwell, a claustrophobe has to confess his or her embarrassing secret. Some building personnel can be naturally sympathetic, like Mike Varley, a doorman in the East 30s who understands. He himself is afraid of heights. Mike has been ushering me up the stairs for years in a building I visit occasionally for medical appointments. He says he deals once or twice a day with people who are afraid of elevators. Not everyone wants to admit to a phobia, but I can tell if they're edgy or hesitant, he said. I'll offer to come in the elevator, or if they're really struggling, I'll let them use the stairs. Another doorman once told me if I had a dollar for every New Yorker who won't take this damn elevator, I'd be a rich man. The walk up is not always pleasant. While staircases were once an opportunity for architects to show off, many can be dark, grimy, and confusing, leaving you at a door that reads, "No re-entry." But to a claustrophobe, a dingy staircase compared with the elevator is paradise. The whole enterprise of getting where I need to be takes planning. If I have an appointment or a social engagement, I'll call to ask if there are stairs. While stairs might be available in the lobby of a building, the door to the destination floor can be locked, and I'll ask a sometimes less than enthusiastic employee to open it for me. Most confounding are those buildings whose stairs are at entirely different entrances from the main lobby. I've had building personnel walk me around the corner to a random entrance to reach a staircase. I'm open about my unease, but other elevator-phobic people suffer in silence, making up excuses to get to the stairs. They forgot something or need to use the bathroom. To get to the safety of the stairs rather than endure the panic that riding an elevator elicits. The panic reaction can be more daunting than the initial phobia, which tends to perpetuate the behavior of avoiding the fear-inducing situation. If you avoid something you're afraid of, there's an immediate feeling of relief, reinforcing the avoidant behavior, which is part of why these things end up being perpetuated, said Lisa Morse, a clinical psychologist on the Upper East Side who specializes in anxiety disorders. Specific phobias can be fascinating. Many health experts speak of poised, smart, successful people whose phobia is totally separate from the rest of their lives. Alfred Hitchcock was afraid of eggs. Julius Caesar, Napoleon, and Alexander the Great were all afraid of cats. Dr. Schachter recalls treating a handsome, rugged, formidable man in his 40s who refused a promotion to a senior position in a construction company because the office was on the 44th floor. The thing about anxiety is that it's really uncomfortable, he said. The terror is really hard to understand, but the fear is so great. In earlier, more anxious days, I'd walk up 18 or 20 flights. My apartment is on the 11th floor. But I've calmed my fears enough so that I can take an elevator. As is the case with other specific phobias, sufferers create idiosyncratic restrictions or allowances around taking them. Some will say that the passenger elevator is safe, but not the service elevator. People create zones of safety for themselves that are not based in reality, Dr. Morse said. They organize their world to make them feel comfortable or justify their behavior, but they're not necessarily useful, nor do they objectively make sense. Often when patients start to talk about them, they realize that. In my own elevator, I rely on predictable sounds or movements that make me feel less apprehensive. I don't characterize myself as someone who doesn't take elevators. I try to work around them within the confines of my own phobic mind. But sometimes I make the decision to endure the panic, which, as most claustrophobic people readily and often with humor acknowledge, is simply not rational. While there are times that it would be easier if I didn't have it, on a day-to-day basis, it doesn't affect my career, my family, or my life. Most people, Dr. Morse said, are not motivated to change because change is hard. It's uncomfortable to do the therapy. So unless it's having a negative impact on your life, most people don't want to put themselves through that. The gold standard of treatment for claustrophobia is exposure therapy, in which a patient is exposed to a ladder of anxiety-provoking experiences related to the fear. The first level might be to look at a picture of an elevator, then to look at an actual elevator, then to get inside without going anywhere, then to go up one floor, then two, and so on. Each step is a critical point at which the patient is asked to assess his thoughts and how he feels. Many therapists will go with the patient into the elevator to work through their issues. Several mental health experts I spoke to commented that the most effective treatment takes a comprehensive cognitive behavioral and psychoanalytic approach, which ultimately allows patients to face their fear, tolerate the discomfort, and have a sense of empowerment from having pushed through something that is difficult. An important part of treatment is the expectation. If you have the expectation that you're going to like them, you're probably not going to feel successful, Dr. Moore said. If the expectation is that you can do it and tolerate the discomfort, that's much more realistic. Until I have that expectation, I'm in agreement with the figure in a cartoon I saw recently. Two people in an elevator are about to go up. One says to the other, "I'm a little claustrophobic. Do you mind if we keep the doors open?" I forgot to tell you the title of that. That was Boxed In, Freaked Out, A Claustrophobe Navigates a Crowded City. We're going to go on to something from Oprah. Oprah Magazine of August 2016, and this was written by Molly Sims. And I will remember the title this time. It is The Healing in Revealing. After the birth of her second child in August 2015, Rayanne Pickett, a tall brunette with a fondness for the F word, found herself consumed by anxiety. "I started to feel so freaked out, sad, and overwhelmed," she says. "I'd stay awake all night, obsessively counting the window panes or the individual slats on each mini blind. I told my doctor, and she was like, 'Yeah, you don't have to do that. There are drugs for that.'" Pickett gratefully took the meds, but that wasn't enough. In her search for other moms experiencing postpartum issues, the 32-year-old communications professional eventually came across This Is My Brave, a live performance series that asks those who've been touched by mental illness to get up on stage and do the seemingly impossible and utterly terrifying, tell their stories in public. When Pickett met the organization's directors at a wellness convention in Washington, D.C., they encouraged her to try out. She laughed off the idea. "I was like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm in no condition to be in a show. I can't even put on pants with buttons right now." But with a little coaxing, Pickett wrote something up, which is how she's come to be standing backstage at the Roslyn Spectrum Theater in Arlington, Virginia, on a sunny Sunday afternoon in May, ready to divulge the intimate details of her postpartum depression and anxiety to some 200 strangers. In the green room, Pickett and her fellow performers nervously crack jokes and try out dance moves. The whip and nine-eye are discussed at length, before doing deep breathing exercises and vocal warm-ups. Out in the Spectrum's airy, glass-walled entryway, a couple dozen ticket buyers mill about, their chatter mixing with the Doobie Brothers ballad humming through the ceiling speakers. Today's event has several sponsors and partners: pharmaceutical companies, a psychiatric treatment center, a local chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the grocery store chain Wegmans, because everybody's got to eat. Some have set up tables stacked with pamphlets. Instead of ushers, counselors in matching teal t-shirts wait in the lobby, ready to speak with any audience member who might become distressed mid-performance. Attendees can nibble on chocolate chip cookies while they browse info provided by a crisis hotline. Almost as soon as the show starts, the crying starts too. Before the day ends, three audience members will ask the counselors for help. The 13 performers, including an education consultant, a nutritionist, and two students, sit together on stage. They range in age from 16 to 57, and they're here to talk about everything from bulimia to post-traumatic stress disorder to clinical depression. Touring musician Eric Scott sings a lovely, unadorned song, his own composition, called Break Me Open, dedicated to his therapist. Annie Powell, a Virginia personal trainer who has bipolar disorder, struggles to focus her teary eyes on her essay, as sniffles echo back from the theater seats. 16-year-old Sydney Woolmuth reads a poem about her battle with depression. "I am sick. Please, someone free me from my free will." And her intensity stuns the audience into silence. But there are also moments of wry rapport and real humor. Knowing smiles appear throughout the theater when Pickett, summing up the experience of caring for two small kids while battling the urge to permanently hide in the bathroom, says simply, "Some days it effing sucks." This Is My Brave is the creation of Jennifer Marshall, a mom and writer who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in spring 2006, after she was hospitalized twice with bouts of mania, staying awake for days at a time. During one episode, she hallucinated that she'd seen a ghost in her baby's room. She's been hospitalized two more times, once while still a breastfeeding mom, the other while pregnant. In both cases, she'd tapered off her medication because she feared it might cause medical issues for her kids. In 2011, back on steady footing, Marshall began blogging about her experiences on a site she titled Bipolar Mom Life. But she never shared her identity. My family and friends all said, "Get your story out, but don't put your name on it, because people will discriminate against you." She stayed anonymous for a year and a half until a parenting website invited her to blog. Marshall gave the site permission to use her name and photo. After her first posts went up, she was inundated with calls, texts, and emails. People who I didn't even know had their own struggles were saying, "Thank you, I've gone through something similar." The experience gave her the idea to put on a show that would bring true mental illness stories to live audiences. Marshall enlisted Anne-Marie Ames, a communications specialist and friend whose son suffers from depression, to work with her on the project. After pricing venues and marketing plans, the two created a Kickstarter page in October 2013. They'd hoped to raise $6,500, but they received more than $10,000 in only 31 days. A few months later, they held auditions, chose performers, and put on the first This Is My Brave show outside D.C. At the reception afterward, Marshall was approached by an emotional audience member with an urgent message. She said, "I drove all the way from Philadelphia to see this. I found your blog in my darkest moment, and your writing saved my life." Offering hope to people still in crisis is the main objective of This Is My Brave. Your brain is just one part of your body, Marshall says, and it can get sick like your heart can. I'm proud of the way I live with bipolar disorder. I'm proud of overcoming four stays in a psychiatric hospital, and that I have two beautiful children and a husband who loves me. It's possible to have that with mental illness. I've seen it with our performers. After the Arlington show, well-wishers wait in the lobby, friends and family ready with cheery flowers and much-needed hugs. Helen Dennis, in a bold print dress, greets her partner and poses for photos. Her piece, My Normal, focused on her lifelong battle with bipolar disorder. Post-game, she smiles and says, "I feel incredibly lucky. It was so freeing. I just hope the audience felt the same way." High school senior Carmine Goddard beams and rushes toward her friends. Some performers seem as wiped out as if they've run a 10K, but they radiate peacefulness. Days later, Pickett still feels a bit transformed. "It's not like I'm cured and everything's perfect, but I'm relieved that I don't have to lie anymore," she says. "I read my essay to one of my coworkers, and now she knows. So I don't have to put a mask on and go, 'Today's going to be a great day.' Just knowing that someone else gets me and can give me a little wink or an eye roll on a stressful day, it's huge." Other performers are equally grateful to feel they're not alone. On our alumni Facebook page, says Ames, you can say, "I spent the day in bed and nobody's going to judge you." Annie Powell says she feels like, "I have a whole new family now. We were all brought together to share something so important." Says Pickett, "We bonded so fast. Now we're all like, okay, are we getting together this weekend?" As Walma suggests, This Is My Brave is a powerful chance to represent. At my high school's suicide prevention assembly, the counselor asked if anyone had struggled with depression. I just sat there. Later, I was so frustrated with myself. But doing this is kind of like raising my hand. Pickett affirms the power of showing the world your flawed, unvarnished self. This Is My Brave gives people an outlet to say, "I'm not okay, and that's okay." It's not a brick-and-mortar nonprofit where you walk in, get something, and leave. It builds a therapeutic place where not everyone has the answers, but we're all trying to figure it out. We have from the Harvard Health blog of May 23, 2016, written by Matthew Solon, What Men Can Gain from Therapy. Speaking for my gender, there are two qualities that define most men. We seldom like to ask for help, and we do not like to talk about our feelings. Combining the two, asking for help about our feelings, is the ultimate affront to many men's masculinity. We like to think of ourselves as strong, problem-solver types, but when it comes to emotional and mental issues, men need to quit trying to bottle up their feelings and tough it out, says Dr. Darshan Mehta, medical director of the Benson Henry Institute for Mind-Body Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Your mental health is equally as important as your physical health. Not addressing negative feelings can carry over to all aspects of your life and have a profound impact. Depression is the most common reason men should seek professional help. Many life situations, jobs, relationships can trigger its trademark symptoms, such as prolonged sadness, lack of energy, and a constant feeling of stress. For older men, it can also be brought on by financial anxiety about retirement, the death of a spouse or friend, or even the loss of independence, like losing the ability to drive. Left unchecked, these feelings could cause other health problems, such as rapid weight loss, insomnia, declining libido, and changes in memory. They may even lead to destructive behavior like alcohol or opioid dependence. While men may recognize these changes when they occur, they may not know the root cause, or if they do, what they can do about it, says Dr. Mehta. This is when a therapist can lend a hand or ear. A therapist can help identify the source of your problems and then help resolve them, he adds. First, talk with your doctor about your situation, how you feel, and your symptoms. He or she will no doubt know therapists who can help with your specific issues. There are other places to start besides your primary care doctor, too. For example, many employee health care plans offer confidential helplines where you can ask questions and find therapists in your network. Another source is the National Alliance on Mental Illness Helpline, 1-800-950-6264. There are many kinds of professionals who offer many different types of therapy. Their individual approaches are based on their particular training and experience. The main ones include psychiatrists, a doctor with a medical degree who can prescribe medication, psychologist, a professional who has a PhD or a PsyD in clinical psychology, licensed professional counselor, he or she has a master's degree plus 2,000 hours of supervised psychotherapy experience. Clinician, nurse specialist, like psychiatrists, they can prescribe medication. And licensed social worker or licensed clinical social worker or licensed independent clinical social worker. These mental health professionals assess and treat people living with mental illness and substance abuse issues. Your therapist should help you establish goals of care and then outline a strategy to meet them. This may include a combination of therapy during regular sessions, as well as homework to follow in between visits. We have time for most of our last article, and this also comes from Oprah, written by Jihan Thompson, and titled Genius Grants. After her son, Zach, was diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder, Laura Pugliano, a single mother in Baltimore, spent 6 years navigating his psychotic episodes and bipolar mood swings. Doctors had prepped her on what to expect, but no one had prepared her for the crushing financial blow she endured as she sought adequate treatment to keep Zach not just alive, but thriving. While she appreciated the emotional support she received from family and friends, what she really needed was money. Ultimately, Pugliano lost Zach to heart failure when he was 23, but she's still fighting for families like hers. Through her nonprofit, Parents for Care, parentsforcare.com, she collects donations and gives small grants to cash-strapped caregivers of people with mental illness. Zach was about to turn 17 when he started saying things like, "There's something wrong with the world and nobody's safe. In a weekend, my child was stolen from me. That's how fast it happened." And yet, no one knew exactly what was wrong with him. One psychiatrist said, "This problem is too big for me," and dumped us. We went from doctor to doctor, paying fees for office visits every week for 6 months before a specialist could tell me Zach was experiencing psychosis. A few months later, they said he had bipolar disorder. Finally, they diagnosed him with schizophrenia. I was working as a government contractor, but things with Zach became so chaotic, I had to quit a couple of projects. I was lucky. I had $200,000 in savings, but once we met the $10,000 cap on our insurance, everything was out of pocket. A prescription that cost $200 one month was $427 the next. And then my job ended. My savings were gone. We were living on $2,300 a month. I scraped and finagled, and my daughter helped pay my credit card bills and ordered us groceries. At a certain point, I realized this must be so much worse for families with no chance of making six figures, who don't have a college education, who have other children to support, and I wanted to help them. So I started a GoFundMe account. I measured a lot of things by pizza. On social media, I would say, "If you'd buy me a $25 pizza, then put that pizza money in my fund instead, and I'll distribute it to families in need. I want to help people keep their homes. I don't want them to have to choose between paying bills and affording treatment for their loved ones. I also want to make people aware of what happens in a family that's dealing with mental illness. Most of the grants I give out are for around $800. One of the biggest was for $1,500. The mom needed help paying the electric company. But even a $450 grant means a lot more than keeping the lights on. It says, we're behind you. Don't give up." And a side column here, did you know the economic burden of schizophrenia was estimated to be $155.7 billion in 2013? And I'm going to give you the number again for the National Alliance on Mental Illness Helpline, and that is 1-800-950-6264. And I encourage you to call that with any questions or concerns or just simply to talk. Thank you for tuning into Sound Body today. Stay well and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.